time once again for Community Forum. And we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Jonathan Grant. Jonathan Grant has been the executive director of the Tenants Union of Washington State since 2010 and previously worked at Solid Ground, a community action organization. He has directly counseled over 3,000 tenants on strategies in asserting their rights across Washington and has successfully advocated for the expansion of tenants' rights on the local, state, and federal level. Jonathan, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
So start out, tell us about the Tenants Union.
Well, the Tenants Union was actually formed by volunteers in 1977, and it was kind of bubbled up from the grassroots. There were a lot of people in the Seattle community that were having problems with landlords, and there needed to be some sort of collective response to build power in the community to respond to those issues. Over the years, the organization grew, and right now we have five different programs. There's our tenant education hotline, which is a statewide hotline that anyone can call. It can be reached at 206-723-0500. It's open on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays. And then we also have various satellite clinics around Seattle that folks can stop by and talk to a tenant counselor about learning what their rights are and how to assert them. The other program of the Tenants Union is our Section 8 Tenant Organizing Project. This is a program where we have community organizers that go into affordable housing or HUD-subsidized buildings, and we work with tenants to collectively bargain with the owner to keep those properties in these subsidized programs so the rents stay low so that the folks can, the low-income folks who live there can continue to stay there for the long term. Then there's our what's called our tenant ownership project, where we actually are in a ownership structure with a the Northwest's first and only tenant-owned property, where the tenants actually work together to purchase the property out from underneath the original owner, who was going to opt out of the subsidy program and kind of and retain that affordability in perpetuity. The Tenants Union also does a lot of legislative advocacy, so we're working on, you know, local levels with the City of Seattle and other municipal areas around King County, and then also statewide advocacy down in Olympia as well. We are primarily a community organizing group. We don't really view ourselves as a social service agency, though we do provide some social services through our tenant education program. Our mission is to empower renters to create systemic change and to organize, educate, and advocate with renters across the state.
So how many renters are there in Seattle and across the state?
Well, I don't have the numbers off for the state off the top of my head, but to give you an idea for the city of Seattle, there's about 157,000 rental units in the city of Seattle, and over 50% of the residents in Seattle are actually renters.
And how many of those now are owned by tenants?
Well, there's lots of different affordability structures out there. Right now, the Benson East Tenant Association, which is down in Kent, Washington, that's the property that we are a part of that ownership structure, and that where the tenants actually own their own buildings. It's about 34 different units, a series of duplexes. It's actually a very beautiful community where the tenants have these amazing gardens, and it's incredibly diverse, where you have Russian, Romanian, Vietnamese immigrants, many of them refugees, living in this community and kind of making it this wonderful place to live. And so that was born out of a community organizing project back in 2000, where it was actually a HUD-subsidized property, where the owner wanted to opt out of this federal subsidy program that kept the rents affordable for very low-income people. And the tenants wanted to fight back and make sure that they had a place to live. And so the Tenants Union worked with the Benson East tenants and formed a tenant association there. And that association was able to raise over $2 million in private funds to purchase the property out from underneath the owner before the subsidy expired. So that way, the affordability for those tenants will remain in perpetuity, because there's no reason why they would want to end their own contracts. So that was a huge success for the Tenants Union.
So define Section 8. Is that the same as HUD subsidies?
Yeah, you know, it becomes a real mishmash of different programs, and there are probably hundreds of different types of subsidies, but one of the largest providers of affordable housing for the very, very low income is the Section 8 program. And that can be either a contract that a building enters into with the federal government or the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, that is called, it's a project-based subsidy, so it stays with the building. And then there's Section 8 vouchers, which is a subsidy that travels with the tenant. So if they move from one building to another building, the subsidy goes with them depending on where they are, even if that building's not a federally subsidized building. Now, beyond that program, there's also tax credit housing, where basically there are what are called private investors, and that could be large multinational corporations like Coca-Cola or Microsoft or what have you, where they will front the money to the government basically and say, you know, here's a block of change. You know, use this to build an affordable housing complex, and in return, the government will give them a tax credit. Now, that is, you know, it might surprise a lot of folks that it's actually not the Department of Housing and Urban Development. They're actually not the largest provider of affordable housing. The largest provider of affordable housing is the IRS through this tax credit program. And it's a wonderful thing that helps a lot of folks, but what people need to understand is that it's not a deep subsidy like what HUD will provide for a very low-income person. Tax credit subsidies are for more working-class people because rents are just, you know, getting jacked up day after day. This program will serve folks that are about 60 or 80% of the area median income, which in Seattle is $60,000. So we're talking about folks that are, firefighters, paralegals, office assistants, you know. But if you were on a fixed income or on Social Security, you would not be able to afford affordable housing.
So when those corporations do those particular deals, do they attach any strings to that, or is it pretty much they got to turn it over?
Well, they pretty much have to agree to – I mean, they don't really get to negotiate with the federal government about what they want to get out of it. It's more or less, you know, do you accept the terms and agreements of these? You know, if you agree to become an investor, then you're putting money in and you're getting this tax credit. The real question is, what do the actual – housing developers who go out and build these properties, what buildings do they build? Where do they build them? How affordable are they? And depending on the subsidy that building gets, it could totally vary what kind of community that will serve. So the tax credits are allocated to each state. And so in Washington State, many nonprofit housing developers will use the tax credit to build an affordable housing complex. And then they'll add an additional layer of subsidy with a Section 8 voucher or with a Section 8 project-based subsidy. They keep the rents even lower for the very low income. So in order to get these rents at a level where people can actually afford, there's often multiple layers of subsidies in order to allow folks to be able to live in those communities.
All right. So talk about what you see as some of the biggest problems that renters are facing right now.
Well, I think it can't be stressed enough. I mean, renters' rights are under attack. I mean, there is a huge problem right now in the state of Washington with the majority coalition caucus that currently controls the Senate. I can't remember the last time that I've seen so many anti-tenant bills being introduced. There were 11 bills that would have stripped away tenants' rights introduced into the legislature this year. And so, by and large, tenant advocates have been kind of playing on, you know, defense in order to stop these things from going through. And to give you an idea of what some of these bills would do, one bill, it's described as the anti-squatter bill. And it's justified as being said that what the bill was what they're saying it's intended for, but it's not at all what it's going to do, would make it easier for a landlord to throw out a squatter. And basically what that would mean is that rather than going through some sort of court process or a formal eviction process, the property owner or even a neighbor could call somebody, could call the police to have the person removed. The bill was written terribly and would have been one of the worst rollbacks of tenant rights that we've seen in many decades. Because one of the issues that the bill didn't address is, you know, what if you're a month-to-month tenant who's got a verbal agreement and you pay your landlord in cash. How are you going to prove you're not a squatter? And even if you could prove that you were a squatter, you would have no recourse to prove it because you wouldn't get to go to court. And in the state of Washington, a landlord cannot do what's called a self-help eviction. They can't just lock you out, lock your doors, or call the police. There needs to be a formal court process, and many renters don't realize this. Many tenants will think that the landlord can kick them out. So I think it's important that folks know that they do have rights, that a court process, by and large, is always required. They have to receive proper notice in a lawsuit. What this bill would have done was to remove all of your due process protections. Basically, if you didn't have some really concrete way to prove that you're a tenant, you could be deemed a squatter, and then the police would haul you out the door. And so we fought that bill down in Olympia this year, and fortunately it did not move forward. But some of the other bills that were anti-tenant are moving forward currently right now in the legislative session's ongoing.
Who proposed that bill? No.
You know, I don't remember who it was, either Senator Roach or Senator Benton, and I'm not sure which of the two. And those are two more conservative members of the Senate.
All right, so that one's not moving forward. Others are moving forward, though?
Yeah, there was another one that we're really worried about. It doesn't really have a clever name. It's just the Deceased Tenants Bill. So basically, the question is, what happens to your stuff when you die? You know, if you're a renter, how long does your landlord have to hold on to your things? You know, and what the bill would have done is that it would have essentially created a kind of a second class status for tenants in probate law, where basically if you die, you have an estate that will often come in and deal with your possessions. You know, maybe you've got, you know, family photos or keepsakes or, you know, property that's worth quite a bit of money. Who knows? What the bill would say is that regardless of what's in your unit, even if you're paid up in rent, the landlord would have if you didn't tell the landlord in writing who was the designated person to get your possessions, the landlord could essentially throw your stuff out. Now, in other areas of the law, there is actually a process for if the tenant abandons the property and just leaves their stuff there. And there's a lot of protections built in when that happens. First of all, the landlord can only throw your stuff out after your rent has defaulted. What this bill would do is that even though let's say you paid your last month's rent and you pass away, you know, expire. Well, then you've got that month that your rent paid and then another month. You might have 60 days to try to, for the estate to go and get your possessions. What this bill would do is that even though you're paid up in your rent, unless you designated somebody for your landlord to follow up with, they would have an ability to throw out your stuff, and they wouldn't have to store it for any meaningful amount of time. And in other areas of law, when this happens, the landlord actually has to sell your property and then give that money back to you, or in this case, to the estate. There is no provision for that. And also, it was crazy. It had this provision in the law that said, here's all the rules and requirements that this law, you know, will require of landlords and tenants. But then it had a provision in it that said the two parties can agree to something else other than what's in this law. And then later in the law it said if you follow this law, the landlord is not liable for any kind of damages. So basically you could have an agreement that said, you know, tenant agrees that all the, you know, income derived from this property that's sold goes to the landlord, and that's just it. Well, that would be legal if this law had passed, and the estate wouldn't be able to sue the landlord because it would remove all of their liability. So that bill is still being discussed. I don't know if it's going to pass out this year, but it is still moving forward, and we're very concerned about it.
Is that prior to this? Is that common to have something with your agreement with your landlord in case I die? You know, because it seems to me if the landlord was presenting things like that, you know, it'd make me question about the place I was moving into.
Yeah, it's. I would be very skeptical of a property owner if they're like, well, in case you pass away, here's what, you know,
in case
what
something
I mean?
Happens.
It's a very problematic proposal on all sorts of levels. And, you know, I think the bigger message is that, you know, with the new conservative majority in the Senate, the rental industry groups are kind of like kids in a candy store. They're pulling all these things off of the shelf that they've been wanting for years, and that's why we had 11 bills this year that we had to fight back, and some of them are moving forward. And I think that's why, you know, organizations like the Tenants Union, which is a membership-based organization, is so critical in times like these, because we're the ones going down there in partnership with other housing advocates testifying against these bills. And, you know, there really needs to be some sort of safeguard for these kinds of encroachments on people's rights, because, I mean, it's outrageous, the things. They're talking about criminalizing, you know, behavior. They're talking about taking your possessions after you die. They're talking about, there's part of that bill would have required you to register every single guest that comes into your home with the landlord, and the landlord would have to approve them. I mean, that's just basic freedom of assembly. You know what I mean?
I mean, someone stopping by to visit you.
That's right. Like, let's say if you, you know, had a caretaker, or let's say that you had a partner that lived off-site, the landlord, if one of these bills that was being introduced was passed, would have the right to approve them and make sure that they weren't a squatter. And so every guest potentially would have to be registered with the landlord and approved. I was actually, you know, it was funny. I was talking to some of the tenants at the Benson East Tenant Association, which is, you know, that tenant-owned property that the TU is a part of. A lot of these tenants are from former communist Eastern Bloc, you know, countries like Romania and Russia. And I was describing these bills to them, and they were saying, you know, and I'm speaking, you know, speaking through an interpreter, and they're talking in Russian and in Romanian, and they're saying to me, my God, you know, it wasn't that bad under the communists, you know, and I'm like, land more freedom over there. So, I mean, these are really serious problems that, you know, really it's remarkable how much energy it takes to try to fight back these kinds of encroachments.
Did we cover the proposed Fair Tenant Screening Act?
So I think what's remarkable for the housing advocates, and I want to give a lot of credit where credit is due, we work in partnership with the Washington Low-Income Housing Alliance, which is an umbrella group of housing advocacy groups, and the Tenants Union is a part of. We've been working in partnership with the Housing Alliance to fight for reforms in the tenant screening industry. And there's a bill right now that's been pulled to the Senate and House floor that would vastly improve tenants' rights, especially for women. And I'll talk about the proposal, but I want to talk about the problem first. So there's this kind of invisible problem for many renters, and almost every renter has been touched by this issue. It's the tenant screening process. It's when you go to apply for housing. It is now pretty much the industry standard to use a private company, a third-party company, to do a background check on a person who applies. Now, the tenant never interacts with this company. In fact, they never get to see the background report that gets created about them. But every time you pay that $35 fee, that's what that money is going towards. You know, it might be $35, it might be $50. And what's utterly criminal about it is that every time that you apply for housing, the property owner will use any number of different companies to pull the exact same information. And it's the tenant that's paying for this product, right? Even though you're paying for this product that essentially protects the landlord's assets, you never get a copy of it, and you have to pay for it over and over and over again. I spoke to a tenant who had spent, it was a small family. There was like two 18-year-olds in the family. And as a result of that, everyone who was over 18 had to fill out a separate screening report. So they're paying for four or five screening reports every time they apply. That amounts to hundreds of dollars just to be considered for housing. So that can rack up, especially if you've got something on your record. So for those folks, they're spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars for these background reports for a product they never get to use. The analogy that I use, it's like you were to buy a DVD box set of your favorite TV series, and then after owning it, you'd have to pay to rent it out every time you wanted to watch the episode you wanted to see. I mean, it's the exact same thing. Now, unfortunately, the bill got stripped down a bit because of the conservative majority in the Senate. It's not going to address just the affordability. The piece that it's really focusing in now is protecting domestic violence survivors. So there's the affordability piece, but then there's this larger question of, well, what can be put in a tenant screening report? And not to mention that, why don't I get a copy of it? You know, this information is being aggregated by these data miners, these companies that just mine public data banks and put it together in this report, and they don't do a great job of analyzing what's in that report. And so many times it'll paint tenants in a false light or include information that might be illegal for them to include it. So What the current Fair Attendance Screening Act does is that it would actually prohibit the use, inclusion of domestic violence protection orders. So if you're a survivor and you're escaping an abusive situation, and you need to get out of that home and find somewhere else to move, it's very often the case that you'll get a protection order to protect you from your abuser. Now, when you do that, you go down to court and you file to get one. Now, that enters the court records, which are all public. And these are called DVPOs, Domestic Violence Protection Orders. That DVPO will then be included on this background report when you go to apply for housing. Now, here's the thing. It's actually already illegal for a landlord to use domestic violence information or your status as a domestic violence survivor in their decision in whether or not to rent to you. So you got to ask yourself, why is it on one hand illegal for a landlord to use this information to discriminate against, you know, women, but on the other hand, it's legal for them to see it, right? Many property owners just won't rent to domestic violence survivors. They're stigmatized in our society. And in 2004, the state legislature took acts to protect them. And that's why it's illegal in the first place. In 2004, domestic violence advocates and housing advocates fought to get these protections for survivors so that they wouldn't be discriminated against in their housing. The one piece that they couldn't get passed, the legislature, was whether or not that information would be included in your screening report. So this year we're finally trying to close. I don't even want to call it a loophole. It's a gaping hole. Where basically it legalized discrimination, what I would call pretextual discrimination, because what happened is that a survivor will apply for housing, the landlord will charge him for the screening report. It'll come back and they'll see, oh wow, that person's got a protection order on it. And then maybe they'll see something else like, you know, their credit score isn't quite what it should be. Or maybe they'll just say that we're the second person in line. There's no way for the tenant to actually know. And it creates this pretextual discrimination where the owner can point to something else on the screening report or just simply say that, you know what, actually you came after this person who came before you and there's no way for the tenant to prove it. So it was this really perfect kind of clandestine way for owners to deny survivors, and the survivor would never know that the protection order was on the report because they don't get a copy of it. So what this bill would do is that it would finally make it illegal for these screening companies to include a domestic violence protection order, which has been something that's been almost 10 years now that we've been fighting to try to get it passed, and it looks like we're finally getting close to accomplishing that this year. If for all your listeners out there, this is something, if you care about women's rights, if you care about tenants' rights, I strongly encourage you to go to our website at tenantsunion.org. This bill is being debated this week. It's on both the House and Senate floor. And if you go to our website at, again, tenantsunion.org, you can see on the landing page there, you can click the link, and there's a letter that you can write to your legislator to encourage them to pass this law. It's totally up in the air whether it'll pass or not, but we really need to get the votes out and make sure people are contacting their legislatures to get the Fair Tenant Screening Act passed.
Do tenants' rights and legislation tend to come from the state or from people's local cities?
Well, it really kind of comes from all over. I mean, what happens with the tenants' union is that we've got that hotline, and it's kind of a barometer for what's going on for tenants out in the community. We hear from folks all across the state, mostly from King County and the Seattle area. This issue of housing access is something that comes up over and over again. And the reason that tenant screening is so central is that regardless of whether you've got a problem with getting a repair in your apartment because you've got a leaky roof, or if your landlord's entering your unit without giving proper notice, or, you know, they're serving you some sort of bogus notice, or you have a disagreement about a provision in your lease, the landlord's ultimate recourse to get you to comply with something is to threaten eviction. So all roads can lead to eviction. Now, if that's the case, and you have a tenant screening industry that kind of tracks every single public record that's out there on you, if you try to assert yourself or avail yourself of your rights in any kind of meaningful way, the landlord can turn around and file an eviction lawsuit against you. Now, again, same thing with domestic violence protection orders. When you file that eviction record, it creates a permanent public record that follows you everywhere you go. In fact, it's a very particular type of record called an unlawful detainer record, which is the kind of legalese way of saying eviction. So let's say, you know, you're living in an apartment complex, the roof has been leaking for weeks, you got black mold growing in the walls, you know, your kids are getting sick from the black mold. You know, your recourse under the Landlord-Tenant Act is to write a letter to your landlord to compel them to fix the problem. All landlord-tenant laws are self-enforced. There's no landlord-tenant police that go out and make your landlord be a good landlord. It's up to you to assert your rights. So let's say you do that. You write the letter and you say, you know, you've got X amount of days, let's say 10 days to begin making repairs. And the landlord fails to do that. Well, there's certain remedies that you're allowed to do. And one of them is to actually make the repair yourself and then deduct it from the next month's rent. And just for anyone who wants to consider that option, you want to document that very well, because here's what happens when you do it. The landlord will often turn around and say, you know what, this was not a lawful deduction of your rent. You are illegally withholding your rent, and I'm going to sue you and evict you for nonpayment. This is very often what happens with this remedy, even though it's a legal remedy that's outlined in the law. So let's say you go through this process, and then you get sued for eviction. You go to court, and you show the judge the photos of the black mold on the wall, you know, the hospital bills that you're, you know, from your kids going being sick, and the judge actually agrees with you that, you know what, you followed the process correctly. You wrote the letter, you documented things, you kept the receipts, and you win. Let's say you prevail in court, and just the mere filing of that eviction record has now permanently marked you as a unrentable. You know, the person, you know, it's like a scarlet letter that follows you everywhere you go. And when you apply for housing, the first thing that most landlords are looking for is, do you have an eviction filed against you? Now, that's an important distinction. Not just an eviction outcome, like did you win or did you lose, was it filed? Because that is an instant red flag. And when the only venue for you to assert your rights is the very same venue that marks you for life as a bad renter, it creates a chilling effect on every renter's ability to be able to assert their rights. Because what person would try to contest something with their landlord if ultimately they could just simply file something with the court that would cause you to be denied housing time and time again and have to pay for all those screening fees and essentially, in many cases, become homeless? So we're talking to tenants all across the state of Washington that are being kind of painted in this false light by these misleading eviction records. And it's crazy. I mean, there's actually a process for somebody with a criminal record to expunge or seal that record after a certain amount of time. I mean, I could actually go out and steal your car and then 7 years later have that record expunged, and then I would, you know, be able to go and get housing. And that's good. That's important. And it's good to reduce recidivism. But then you have a tenant who's a good actor and actually won in court. That person doesn't have an ability to remove that eviction record. And so when they apply for housing, it's going to show up every single time. The Fair Tenant Screening Act this year had a provision in it that would have prohibited screening companies from using eviction records where the tenant won or the case was dismissed. Unfortunately, because of the pushback from the conservative components in the legislature, that was stripped out of the bill. So we're going to have this incredible accomplishment for protecting women and protecting domestic violence survivors. But when it comes to tenants who prevailed in court, you know, another year has gone by where the legislature has decided not to act on this.
Well, unfortunately, we are just about out of time. We're talking with Jonathan Grant. He is executive director of the Tenants Union of Washington State. And tell people again how they can get a hold of your organization.
Again, you can visit our website at tenantsunion.org. And there's a lot of great information. We're a membership-based organization, and the only way that we're successful in fighting these laws is when decision makers and policymakers know that, we have a constituency. So I really encourage your members to join if you're a member. All that information is on the website. And if you need help or in seeking assistance, you can contact our hotline or go into our walk-in clinics, and all that information is also on our website. Again, our hotline is 206-723-0500. I will admit, though, it is a statewide hotline, so it is often very hard to get through. I just encourage folks to keep on trying, and there are other resources on our website. It's actually one of the best resources is online. Yeah.
All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Okay. Thank you.